17. Of St. Lazarus and the Rotten Fruit. The soldiers passed them near the town of Nemours, just as deep, cold woods gave way to overgrown and deserted farms. They had just broken camp, and their hunger gnawed at them. They had begun to discuss the possibility of eating their mule. Rather, Thomas had started discussing it, provoking fierce resistance from Delphine and causing the priest to say, "I would rather starve than walk."
"We can all see our ribs. It isn't right. We could smoke this bastard and eat like kings for a week."
"Did you see his ear twitch?" Delphine said. "He hurt you."
"I don't care if he did."
"You can't really want to eat our friend. He's been so faithful."
"I have to eat something. I'm losing my whoring mind."
"Not the mule," she said,
and that put an end to it. The soldiers came then, just at first light. No fewer than 6 knights and another 20 men-at-arms rode up on them, the horses' hooves shaking the road. A voice shouted,
"Get that cart out of the way!"
Barely leaving them enough time to do so, startling Père Mathieu so that he reined the mule hard, taking one wheel off the road and causing them all to be buffeted by low branches. One of the knights called,
"Ho!"
slowing his horse to a stop and obliging the rest to stop as well.
"I know that man,"
the knight said, wheeling his horse around to get another look at Thomas. Thomas recognized him too, though he could not retrieve his name or title. His surcoat bore a red chevron bisecting a silver griffin rampant on a field of blue.
"That man fought at Crecy, and bravely too."
Thomas squirmed with shame at his shoddy armour and his mule cart, and wished the troop would ride on.
"Am I right? You were beside the Comte de Givrat when he fell."
"I was."
"Where is your coat of arms?"
"I lost it at dice."
The man stared at him for a moment while he decided whether Thomas's comment was a joke or an insult. He decided it was a joke.
"Ha!"
he barked.
"What are you doing in that cart, man?"
"We're going to the Holy Land to fetch back the true cross."
"Ha! This is a man of levity. He might lighten our journey with his japes if he were of a mind to come with us."
"Never mind him,"
said a youthful knight with golden locks.
"Can't you see he's fallen? This man is a brigand."
Thomas chafed, but Delphine put her hand on his before he could rest it on the hilt of his sword.
"What is a brigand in these days? Which of you does not charge tolls on travellers? And woe to those who do not pay their due, eh? Besot me! I'll not have you insult a man who rode up that hill while you dandled dolls in Evry."
The blonde knight grimaced, but did not respond.
"What say, man? We've got a spare horse. It's yours if you'll ride with us."
Delphine's hand gripped Thomas's harder, but he pulled away from her.
"Where are you bound?"
"Avignon. His Holiness has summoned certain knights to him. There's talk of a new crusade."
"Jerusalem?"
"Aye, so it is whispered. He will not issue a bull until the English have declared they will join us, though it is said their king already gave his word."
Thomas considered this.
"We are also bound for Avignon."
"Then it is decided. Bring up the bay."
An acneous squire in saffron yellow rode up now, holding the reins of a handsome bay stallion.
"Where may my companions ride?"
The knight leaned closer, looking the priest and the girl over.
"In the cart, of course, as befits their station. We will be in Avignon before a fortnight. This cart will still be clopping about at Christmas time. On your horse, man, and let them meet you there."
Aye,
this is not the time for speeches, sir. On your horse and piss standing up, or in your cart and squat for it.
Go your ways, Thomas said coolly, and I will go mine.
Did that knight's nose just wrinkle like a lion's? His surcoat was different now. Behind the chevron, a lion rampant tore an old man in an arena. Monkeys eating a wild-eyed horse. The dead woman's moldy back in the pit.
Who is the girl? The knight said.
Just an orphan.
Who is she, really?
Ask your mother.
Ha!
Thomas's hand drifted for the handle again, and again Delphine steered it away, saying under her breath,
It's what they want. These are only shades, but your anger is feeding them. Get rid of it.
Ha!
Thomas said. Then he imagined the knight's nose was the tail of a horse. He pictured it lifting and a pile of road apples falling out of the knight's mouth. His defiant ha turned into an actual laugh, and he let himself laugh freely. The knight's face reddened. He showed his teeth for just an instant. Thomas laughed harder. The knight gathered himself enough to speak again, his voice trembling.
Would that we had more time. I would like to discuss this further with you. But we are stayed for. Perhaps our paths will cross again, when we may linger in knightly fellowship.
Good luck on your crusade, the priest offered.
Go to hell,
the squire in yellow said, unconsciously fingering one of his pimples. They turned their horses and thundered down the road leading to Nemours, tramping autumn's first golden leaves into the black mud beneath them. They were not out of sight the length of a troubadour's verse before the sun peaked between the trees. Nemours would not let the three of them in. The gates were barred, and the very skinny man at the parapet told them they would be shot if they rode closer.
Where may we ford the river, then? If we may not use your bridge?
I don't know.
Where may we find food?
Wait till one of you starves, he advised. Then eat that one. That's how we're managing. We call it Gigot de Nemours. But no one comes in, and by God, no one goes out.
On the other side of the town, near the banks of the Loing, they came across an encampment of 20 or so men and women hauling in nets and working little patches of field. It was unusual to see such industry now. Something was cooking in a large stew pot, and it smelled like hot, greasy heaven. The priest pulled the cart up to the rough-hewn new wood fence. A woman with very red cheeks and a veiny nose motioned two men over. They had been working a two-man saw, but now they put that down and hefted wood axes, holding them casually over their shoulders, standing near the woman. The trio walked uncommonly close to the cart. People just didn't walk up to strangers like this anymore. The priest unconsciously leaned back from them.
Are you healthy?
The priest asked.
I don't give a shit if they aren't, Thomas said. We're asking them for food. If I have to eat it from a leper's hands.
We're healthy now, the woman said. If you don't mind my asking, what does that mean? It means we've already had it here. And it's gone. It's never gone. I mean, we've all had it. And lived. Nobody gets it twice. We call our town St. Lazarus. The bastards behind the walls wouldn't let my husband and me in. He died. I didn't, and neither did my boys. The girls died, though. Four of them. Others came. Now Nemours is full of scarecrows and cannibals, and we get survivors every week or so. We'll let you move in if you're willing to spend the first night in a sick blanket. Have any of you had it?
Just him.
The priest said, indicating Thomas.
Yep, He looks strong, though you can't always tell by that. We think it's 1 in 5 gets through, as long as it's the swelling kind. The blood coughers all die. The ones who turn black die too, and quick. We didn't have any of those in my town.
Lucky you.
We're starving. Can you help us?
The woman scratched her chin, looking them over.
Will you work for it?
God, yes.
What can you do?
He kills people, I read Latin, the little girl asks questions, and also reads Latin.
All right. The big one helps build the fence. You too, and the girl mends nets. You give us a half day of work, and we'll feed you tonight. But then you're on your way tomorrow. We don't want to start liking you and have you up and die on us.
You've got a deal. Would you like me to say a mass for you in the morning?
What, God in heaven? The only thing I say to God is my daughter's names, and it's not a prayer, it's a rebuke. We'll thank you not to say any blessings at dinner.
The work was hard, but good. Delphine learned the fine points of net mending from a little boy whose parents had died, and whose father, mad with fever, had tried to blind him with a hot poker so the boy wouldn't catch the illness through his eyes. He managed to snuff only one eye before the boy, who was already infected, ran to his uncle's house and carried it there. He awoke from his fevers to find himself alone in a dead house. Nobody else would take him in, so he walked to Nemours, and then St. Lazarus. The woman ate first, with her sons. Then they served the rest, measuring it out to the drop, so all got the same portion.
"This is exceptional stew," the priest said. "What's in it?"
The woman told him. "Cabbage, turnips, mushrooms, pork belly, and a few pinches of real pepper." And at precisely that moment, a sparrow in the tree above Thomas shat in his. They slept in a threshing room that still smelled like last year's barley, and in the morning they got back into the cart. The woman gave them a sack of blueberries and a squash to take with them, and told them there was a town 3 miles downriver with a wooden bridge still standing.
"What's its name?"
the priest asked.
"Doesn't matter. Everyone's dead. It'll be all weeds in a year, except for the steeple. Oh, and if you see any yellow fruit in the trees, don't eat it. It's rotten."
She laughed inscrutably at this, then slapped the mule's ass to get it moving, showing them the calloused palm of her hand in farewell as they clopped away. The woods got thick again, and beneath the limbs of a very old oak tree they saw a flash of yellow. As they got closer, they saw that it was a cotehardie, saffron yellow, adorning the week-old, grinning corpse of a hanged squire. They all knew that cotehardie, and knew that its owner had once had pimples. There was a sign around his neck. The priest shivered and crossed himself. Rapist. 18. Of the Penitents and of Auxerre. The first sign of the group they were following was their tracks. They had pocked the damp ground of the road with their footprints, as any large group walking would have. But every 100 yards or so they left an imprint where it seemed as though they had all fallen and pressed their bodies into the mud. Also, Thomas had noticed the white stumps of freshly snapped branches on trees near the road, with tracks leading up to those trees. When they got to the town of Pontchelvert, a strange sight greeted them. Someone had crucified a dwarf. He was still very much alive, however. As the cart drew closer, they saw that he had been tied in place rather than nailed there, and his feet rested on a little platform, although he was wearing a crown of very real thorns. A ladder lay in the grass near him, as well as a bucket of water with a sponge on a long stick. He did not speak to them as they approached, though he watched them the whole way. Père Mathieu stopped the mule, and they all looked at him, dumbstruck. He nodded at the bucket. Delphine clambered out of the cart and soaked the sponge, which she then held up to his mouth. He lipped at the sponge in a way that made her think of a sheep.
"Do you want to come down?" she said.
He shook his head.
"Are you sworn to silence?"
"No," he said. "They didn't say anything about that."
"They who?" said Thomas.
"The penitents."
"Who?"
"Never mind."
He closed his eyes now, moving his lips silently in prayer.
"Pardon me," Delphine said.
"What?"
"You should come down," she said. "That can't be good for you."
"I have 2 days to go. I'm only on my first day, and each town is to crucify someone for 3 days, don't you know?"
"No,"
she said.
"It's the only way."
"The only way for what?"
"If you're going to make me talk, give me more water. My throat hurts."
She dipped the sponge again and held it aloft for him.
"The only way to appease God, so he'll take the pestilence away."
"Oh,"
she said.
"Very wicked towns are to crucify 3 people, but we were no better or worse than most."
"Who decides how wicked your town is?" said Père Mathieu, fascinated.
"They do."
"Were you out in the rain?"
Delphine asked.
"They came after the rain. They came yesterday."
"Do you have to stay out all night?"
she said. He tried to ignore her and return to his prayers, but she repeated her question.
"They come and take me down at night."
"The penitents?"
"No, the town. The penitents are headed for Auxerre to perform a great miracle."
"Come down,"
she said. He shook his head.
"Why you?"
"What?"
he said again, clearly annoyed.
"Why did they pick you? Did you volunteer?"
"The town picks. They vote. It's a big honour."
Thomas laughed, and the dwarf gave him a dirty look.
"Are you sure they're coming back for you?" Thomas said, still amused.
The dwarf went back to his prayers.
"Deus meus, ex toto corde penitet me omnium meorum peccatorum, eaque detestor, quia peccando non solum penas."
"Because if it were me up there, I'd start thinking maybe the good people would leave me on the cross to make sure God was happy. Did you think of that?"
"Non solum penas ad iuste statutas pro meritus sum, sed presertim quia offendi."
The girl looked at Thomas.
"I think you should take him down."
"He clearly wants to stay there," the priest said. Thomas smiled. He knew the girl wanted to keep the man from harm. Thomas liked the idea less for that reason, and more because he knew the dwarf would fuss about it, and he was glad to do something good that was also entertaining. He didn't expect the fight he got, though. As soon as he untied the dwarf's feet, the small man started kicking at Thomas so hard he made the cross rock. It was all Thomas could do to keep the ladder upright, especially since he was laughing the whole time. Delphine furrowed her brow at Thomas's attitude, and the priest paced restlessly, afraid one of them would be hurt. Thomas had the dwarf over his shoulder and nearly down the ladder when his burden kicked against the side of the cross and tipped the ladder, spilling them both into the soggy grass.
"You little bastard!" Thomas said, angry now.
The little man fumed at him from where he sat in the high grass. The priest thought of a surly rabbit and laughed into his hand despite his best intentions. The dwarf tried to climb the cross and resume his place, but Thomas grabbed him by the breeches and hauled him down again.
I want to save my town!
The dwarf screamed, with tears of frustration in his eyes, and the game lost its humour, even for Tomas.
Do you really want to go back up there?
Tomas asked. The man sat down in the grass and looked bewildered.
I don't know,
he said.
But don't you see? This is the one thing I can do as well as anyone else. I can't plough, I can't build, but I can suffer. God wants suffering now.
The priest opened his mouth to contradict the man, but nothing came out.
Shit, Tomas said.
And then he hauled the dwarf back up the cross and tied him fast. Emma Latour looked out from the darkness of her house, stunned by the beauty of the day. Except for visits to the well, she had not left her home since her Richard had been racked with pains by the fence and died there. At the end, he had been grabbing his knees, and now his joints had locked him in a parody of childbirth, bloated like a dead dog or sheep. How was she to believe man was anything special when he looked so much like any other animal in death? He was just a rained-on, ruined carcass, as if he had never kissed her, as if he had never danced. The beautiful blue sky seemed to mock him, as did the bulk of the Saint-Étienne Cathedral and the spire of the abbey, both of these stabbing upward from the high ground across the river in Auxerre. Nothing but false promises lay across the river, or up in the sky. Her carrots were nearly gone, and she was sick to death of them. They hurt her few teeth, and she checked the skin of her arms constantly, because she had the idea the carrots were turning her yellow. She needed to cross the bridge into town, though the thought made her shiver with fear. If only her sons would come. But they had their own children to think of, and she had not seen any of them in a week or more. Her little cottage had been forgotten. Now she was looking out of her window, staying well back from the light so it wouldn't illuminate her yellow skin. She heard a voice coming across the fields, and it was beautiful. It belonged to an angel. She saw him, or her, sprinting down the weedy path, wearing a white skirt of sorts, ruched up to the belt for running, bare of chest and foot. It was a boy, nimble as a fox, and so lovely to watch, with his tangled blonde hair bouncing. The child angel leapt upon her fence of uneven branches and balanced along its length, calling to the window in a beautiful, heavily accented sing-song, as if he could see her where she cowered in shadow.
And the angel opened their seal, and all of Auxerre behold, for they are afraid, but now their holy men are come, so holy from God in heaven, to make miracles on their square. Come and see, in front of their church, but not in it, for thrown down are the priests, and dead are their bishops. Come and see, come and see. People of Auxerre, come and see.
He leapt off the fence and over the birthing corpse of her husband and ran through the field, which was spotted purple with new growths of thistles. Emma had a mother's instinct to yell at him not to stick his feet on their evil little crowns of spines, but he ran through them as if on purpose, then dove and actually rolled through the thickest patch of them, laughing and shouting,
Jesu! Jesu! Jesu!
The penitents had come to Auxerre. The 60 farmers, carpenters, drapers, vintners, wives, and daughters who stood in cool sunlight near the Saint-Étienne Cathedral had all been summoned by the beautiful boy. He gathered them with his songs and gambols, but especially with his promises of miracles against the plague. Hucksters of every stripe had tried to profit from the disease, especially in the early days, before they, too, sickened or grew afraid. So many relic sellers and apothecaries had come that soon any stranger with a case and a gleam in his eye was in danger of being beaten and flung into the Yun, along with his sweetly herbed potions, deer bones, magic feathers, garland cakes, or sap from the cedars of Lebanon. When the disease bore down and the die-off began, the town was left alone, although her gates stood open. The bishop had said, when asked for his counsel on whether to impose a quarantine, "The fox already makes his bed among the hens," which was very close in spirit to the seigneur's observation that closing those gates would be leading hens to piss. Auxerre, thus, dutifully flew the black banner announcing the presence of the great death, but remained open to whoever cared to brave it, be they pilgrims, refugees, or men with pretty lies to tell. But now the boy had come, and he was different. He was quite credible as the herald to a prophet, with his eyes of northern ocean blue and his dimpled smile. Even his German accent, normally a hindrance in these xenophobic times, lent him an air of exoticism. After all, if some holy cure were to come to Auxerre, it would not come from Burgundy. Why not the piney forests of the north? But this boy sold no cures. He never mentioned money at all.
"Wait!" he said,
capturing his audience with an up-pointed finger and a theatrical tilt to his head.
"I believes I hear them, but perhaps you will hear them too, if you make the Alleluia."
Nobody spoke.
"Children of God, make their Alleluia!"
"Alleluia!"
they cried, and a drum began to beat a simple march. The sound came up through the narrow streets that led down and to the river, and echoed on the shuttered shop fronts and timbered houses that bordered the square. A line of ecstatic men and women entered the Place Saint-Étienne, shuffling slowly in something like a drugged march, striking themselves in time to the drumbeats with the leather thongs fitted with iron hooks or spikes. They were naked from the waist up, like the boy, all wearing simple skirts that had once been white, but had been marched in and bled on until they were the colour of earth and as stiff as leather. The crowd gasped at the sight of them. The women's bare breasts, the old blood drying, the new blood trickling, the white caps they wore with red crosses on the front and back. Some of the Auxerrois even fell to their knees wailing, thinking judgment day had come, here, now, and soon Christ himself would split the sky and part the damned from the saved. Now four women called out, and four men answered.
"Jesu, will you die for us?"
"Yes, love! Yes, love!"
"Do you fear the Roman whip?"
"No, love! No!"
And then the men called and the women answered.
"Sinners, will you bleed for me?"
"Yes, love! Yes, love!"
"Do you fear the pestilence?"
"No, love! No!"
Then all together.
"Who will come and walk with us in his steps, to show him that our love is true? 30 days!
Behind these eight and the drummer trained a score or so who had clearly been recruited from other towns, all stripped to the waist, though less uniform in appearance. Some of them whipped themselves with tree branches. A girl walked behind bearing a bundle of sticks on her back to replace those that split. Now the drummer beat three beats, and they all stopped. They shouted,
"Jesu!"
and flung themselves face down into the street, arms out, cruciform, eliciting a gasp from the crowd. The ones at the rear then stood and came forward, giving a stroke of the whip or the branch to each prone figure they passed, until they reached the front and flung themselves down again. In this way, like some horrible caterpillar, the entire line worked its way toward the square in front of Saint-Étienne and the astonished crowd of onlookers, then collapsed all at once. All but the man beating the drum. He set this aside now and looked at the crowd.
"I am Wutke the Fair,"
he said, drawing himself up to his full height. Fair might have been a name from his youth. It seemed a better word to hang on an urbane womanizer than on this handsome but shocking man of 30 or so, graced with the broad, muscular chest of a woodcutter or a swordsman, brutally scarred from months of flagellation. His carelessly shaven or intentionally cut scalp would have sat well on a madman, but his deep-set eyes shone with intelligence, even wisdom. A goatish beard of blonde and grey erupted from his chin. He seemed less a cleric than the antidote to clericism. If Christ had been German as well as a carpenter, and if he had survived his scourging, and if he had shorn his head with a broken bottle, he might well have looked like this man.
"I come to you, Auxerre, from the land of Saxony, where the plague is not yet come, and shall never come. I stand before you to offer you either the cup or the sword. The cup is that of forgiveness, and the sword is that of wrath."
Now the boy came up from behind the crowd, bearing a pewter goblet and a small sword. He stood by the man, stomping his feet twice.
"God demands a tithe. If 1 in 10 of you turn from your lives of false comfort and walk with us for 30 days, your town will be spared. Or if 3 of you will sit the cross for 3 days, your town will also be spared. But if you stay here and do not show the Lord your love, you will all die the death of the stone under the arm, or the stone in the crotch, or the death of the spitting of the blood. I see by your faces you know these deaths, yeah? Well, you have now the chance to turn the face of death away from you. Shall I speak further on God's offer, or will you harden your hearts and go to your houses to die in sin?"
"Speak on,"
someone yelled. Another repeated it.
"Hop,"
Rutger said, and the cruciform penitents behind him stood, arms out, faces lifted to the sky. Some of them were sobbing. He spoke. Emma watched, amazed, as the butcher and a vintner named Jules, who had once courted her sister, came bearing a two-wheeled cart. They put her poor, stiff husband in it, revolted by his decomposition, but seemingly unafraid of his disease. Why were they not calling out to her? Because she sat in shadow, and they thought she was dead too, like almost everyone on this side of the Yann. Or they thought that she had run away.
"Where are you taking him?"
she asked, letting a little sunlight fall on her face so they could see her. She winced as much from the sunlight as from her fear of their reaction to her colour. But she did not startle them. If they thought she was yellow, they were very polite about it.
"The cathedral,"
Jules said.
"You'll want to see this, Emma."
"Are you burying him?"
"No, Emma. Come to Saint Etienne."
So saying, they carted her Richard away, his knees still locked against his chest, the little blonde boy now visible, skipping before them through the thistles and singing a song in German. The sun was lowering when the three dead Auxerrois were brought before the cathedral of Saint Etienne. Richard was the worst of them, having been dead a week, but 2 others had been chosen. A beautiful young maid, who had broken hearts in the wine shop by the front gate, was only 1 day gone, though her beauty had already been cast down. She had been healthy at daybreak, but by nones the plague had turned her the colour of an eggplant and killed her outright. The third was Yvette Michonneau, the bishop's acknowledged mistress, who died after fighting grimly through an unheard of 10 days of lancings and bleedings, leaving behind 3 of the Bishop of Auxerre's chubby, dark-eyed bastards. She had been wrapped in a shroud and buried, but the German boy commanded her to be retrieved. Yvette's mother also a fighter, had brawled in the churchyard to keep her daughter's hard-won Christian burial from being upset. Grabbing away the sexton's shovel and breaking one penitent's nose with it before being wrestled down and hustled off by her neighbours. Auxerre had tried to please God with Christian burials, but clearly something more was required. The cart was drawing near Auxerre. The square tower of the cathedral beckoned them as they topped a hill near Perigny, but, with only an hour of sun left, they decided to make camp near the wall of an old convent, long abandoned and swarmed with ivy, now blushing mostly red. All the ivy in the abandoned village of Perigny crawled toward Auxerre, as if reaching for it with delicate fingers. The girl slept hard, and neither man wanted to rouse her from her sleep. Thomas covered her with their horse blanket, and then he and the priest left her and went into the damp woods bordering the field, looking for sticks dry enough to burn. Delphine woke alone in the cart, her heart racing from a dream that a devil was in Auxerre, turning people into poppets. In the dream, she was able to stop it, but the devil, who had too many eyes, was very angry, and it chased her. That was when she awoke. She knew the dream was true, and this frightened her so much that she pulled the blanket over her head. Then she thought of her father and mother, and of how she would have felt to see either of them turned into a devil's plaything. She gathered her blanket around her, meaning to set off down the road, knowing she didn't have much daylight in which to walk the last few miles. An angel was sitting on the back of the mule, facing her and wringing its hands. It was the same one she had seen in Paris and back home in Normandy. It was the saddest she had ever seen an angel look. It told her to stay in the cart, speaking as if every word hurt it.
"Why?"
she said. She would only make things worse, it said. However noble her desire was, getting to Avignon was all that mattered.
"Is a devil going to Auxerre?"
"Yes, a very strong one is already there, and another is coming."
"Who will help the people in the town? Will you?"
It hung its head. It was a minor angel, made better at messages than war. The strong ones were fighting in heaven. Delphine thought, from the way the angel spoke, that this fight must not be going well. She wanted to cry. What would happen to the souls in heaven if the angels lost? Would they have to go back to their bodies? Now she imagined her mother and father at the end of a stick, jerking beneath a devil's hand in a parody of a dance.
"Stay in the cart."
She could not bear to say no to the angel, so she shook her head, though so gently a person might not have noticed. She looked around to make sure the priest and the knight didn't see her, because they would stop her, or follow her and put themselves in danger. She bent to muddy her finger and wrote on the side of the cart. Then she patted the mule's side, as much to comfort herself as him, and started off down the road barefoot.
"Please,"
the angel said behind her, and she stopped for a heartbeat and then kept going. She was afraid she might lose heart, so she made herself count 10 steps before she looked behind her. The angel was gone. Thomas found the cart empty, with writing on its side. He put his meager bundle of sticks and chestnuts on the ground and called the priest over. The priest read it aloud. "Stay here." Fully 100 people had gathered to see the penitents perform their miracle in the square before Auxerre's cathedral. A light breeze blew, but it was not so cold since the rains stopped. Rutger's followers held candles, the last candles the remaining Benedictine monks at the Abbey of Saint-Germain had. They wanted no part of the penitents' display, but the Auxerrois had told them plainly that they would have no more food brought to them unless they gave over their tapers. The brothers had already killed their last hog and chickens, and their measly garden could not get them through the winter. They had reminded the crowd that starving out monks was not high on the list of deeds that would get one into heaven. Further, the abbey was dedicated to Saint Germanus, who had taught Saint Patrick and argued against the Pelagian heresy, and these brothers were the keepers of his holy bones. When Gilles, the armourer, suggested that these bones might be put into broth, the monks knew they would get nowhere appealing to the better natures of the Auxerrois, and the candles were surrendered. Rutger beat his drum, slowly at first, then faster and faster. The penitents, having handed their candles off to the people, bloodied themselves with their whips and branches in time to the rhythm, ending in an orgiastic frenzy that actually sprayed droplets into the crowd. The madness spread from the flagellants to the townsfolk. Many cried out or swayed, and some were moved to begin striking themselves or one another.
"Ma!"
shouted Rutger, and the blonde boy echoed him, crying,
"Ma!"
His open-mouthed grin might have been the same if he were sledding down a steep hill. Some in the crowd punched each other. Then the biting began, and the scratching. One who held a candle held it to his face, lighting his beard, then slapping it out with a hoarse scream. At the crescendo, Jules cut his little finger off with his own knife, shocking Emma, who stood near him open-mouthed. Rutger saw this and smiled for the first time, showing his crooked teeth.
"Yes," Rutger said. "And so, it is enough."
He beat the drum one time hard. The crowd's violence ebbed, and they edged closer. Now he pointed at his acolytes, the four men and women who had given the call and response. They took their evil, hooked whips and stood near the dead. Rutger banged at the drum.
"Death, where is your power?"
he asked.
"Gone,"
responded the eight, whipping the dead ones. With each question, he banged the drum. With each response, the dead were scourged.
"Death, where are your teeth?"
"Broken."
"Death, where are your wings?"
"Gone."
"Death, where is your staff?"
"Broken."
"Death, where is your glass?"
"Gone."
With this last stroke, the body of Yvette Michonneau jerked. The crowd gasped.
"Death, whom do you serve?"
"The Lord."
"Death, will you obey?"
"Yes, love."
"Death, will you relent?"
"Yes, love."
Now all of the dead spasmed when struck. Some at the edges of the crowd ran away, but others leaned in, eyes wide. The last slice of sun dipped below the horizon, leaving the sky lavender and pink.
"Death, will you release this woman?"
"Yes."
Yvette stood in her shroud. A stain spread from where her mouth was. A woman screamed while a few men cheered and more ran.
"Death, will you release this girl?"
"Yes."
The once pretty barmaid stood, her blackened face searching the crowd, bewildered.
"Death, will you release this man?"
"Yes, love, yes."
After three savage whip blows, Richard unbent his legs and rolled over on his stomach. He lacked the strength in his limbs to stand unaided, so the acolytes helped him. He swayed there, his simple cap still tied below his chin, moving his ruined jaw as if to speak, but nothing came out. Another half dozen broke and ran, including two shirtless penitents who had come from the last town.
"When these sisters and this brother are strong enough, I will send them to find the unbelievers who ran from this holy place. They are very good at finding, and all of you who march with me shall be proof against the plague. For if you die, I will make you live again, as you have seen with your own eyes.
Emma, who had been watching all of this as if in a dream, moved forward shouting,
No!
Rutger saw her and said,
This woman fears for her husband, even as Lazarus was feared. But her man will heal and love her once more. All these departed shall be restored to health, if you believe.
This is wrong,
Emma shouted, pointing her cane and then pathetically,
Leave him alone.
Wrong? How can this be wrong when it comes from the Lord?
It is only for Christ to raise the dead, and I do not think you are him.
Are you sure? There is no middle place, you know. You had better be sure.
If you're a man of God,
Emma said,
pray the Paternoster.
Rutger smiled and wagged his finger at her, as if she were a naughty child.
Lord, Rutger said, if this woman's disbelief displeases you, show us some sign.
The boy threw the stub of a carrot at her, hitting her dress. The crowd gasped. Everyone was looking at her, many with their mouths open in disbelief. She looked at her arms and saw why. She had turned yellow. Now a voice from the crowd spoke up.
Stop it!
A young girl in a dirty gown stood near the front of the crowd, holding a blanket around her.
Stop it!
She shrieked. The people of Auxerre parted to let her through. All of the penitents, even Rutger, were dumbstruck at the sight of her, and nobody stopped her as she went to poor old Richard and kissed his hand. As soon as she did, he collapsed and returned to death.
No!
Rutger shouted. The boy ran over to her, shouting madly,
Fastasto! Fastasto!
She ignored his words and shouldered him aside, now kissing the hand of the wine maiden, who also gratefully crumbled. Now the boy pushed her from behind, but instead of falling, she let the momentum carry her forward toward Yvette, whose hands were still bound in the shroud. The girl knelt and kissed one of her bare feet, causing her, too, to fall. The boy spun the girl around.
Was tust du, Hexe? I'm sorry,
she said, looking at him, even through him, with her sad, luminous grey eyes.
It's not your fault, but you're dead, too.
She kissed the beautiful boy on the cheek, and he exhaled in a long rasp, and did not inhale again. Rather, he turned back to the plague-spotted dead boy he had been when Rutger found him, and fell as if exhausted into Delphine's arms. She laid him down and gently closed his eyes. Now two of the penitents grabbed Delphine's arms brutally, shouting,
Witch! Witch! Let go of her!
Shouted a woman.
No! She is a witch!
A man screamed, and soon the crowd was pushing and tearing at itself, some trying to get at the girl, some trying to protect her. She was slapped sharply, and her hair was yanked so hard it hurt her neck. The acolytes who held her pulled her back, looking at Rutger for leadership, but he was oblivious to them, staring at the girl as if he might stare through her skin and see what she was. The crowd had become a mob. Those who saw the girl as wicked had overpowered the others and now surged toward the acolytes, who threw her to them and ran. The crowd grabbed her roughly, tearing her blanket from her and using it to bind her arms to her sides. She knew she was too weak to fight them. She wished Tomas were here, then blinked that wish away, knowing he would die for her and still the mob would have her. They lifted her up above them, and she was sure they would dash her head against some wall. It seemed they were all shouting at once. She let her body go limp, trying to see it from outside herself. If she must die, she would neither cry nor cry out. It was all she could do, so she focused on that. She would die bravely.
Rutger was walking closer, still staring at her.
What are you?
Throw her in the yun, one shouted.
Yes, and with a stone around her neck.
They had started moving in that direction, toward one of the dark little streets that led steeply downhill and to the river, but they did not leave the square with her. A woman who was holding Delphine's leg screamed, then another. Delphine was dropped, but thankfully landed on her feet. She worked her arms free from the hastily bound blanket as a man yelled,
I'm blind! Me too, said another.
God help us!
Rutger pulled the tongue from the one who said that and flung it to the ground, now looking around madly for whatever or whoever had struck the people blind. All of the townsfolk and acolytes near the girl had lost their sight, falling on all fours, groping their way toward the walls of the church or the buildings nearby, moaning or sobbing or praying. She took a thumb in the eye from one of them, got kicked in the back, and scampered between the legs of another. It was chaos. A knight with a face somewhere between a man's and a lion's had entered the square from the direction of the river. His armor was bloody, as was the axe he carried head down in his left hand. He was riding a greyish horse with human mouths where its eyes should be and hands instead of hooves. Rutger, who was a head taller than he had been, started moving toward Delphine, flinging the blind out of his way. His eyes seemed to be multiplying, now four, now eight. The ghastly horse at the far end of the square reared, the hands at the ends of its forelegs grasping at the air. Now Delphine saw the angel. It stood in an alley, unseen by the devils in the square, more purely itself than it had been upon the mule. Its beauty crushed something inside Delphine and made nectar of it. It looked right at her. Then, with what seemed very little effort, it pushed over the glover's shop it stood next to, a woman screaming from the top floor. The building fell heavily between Delphine and the devils, shielding her from their view. The angel said only one word. It said,
Run!
19. Of the War Drawing Near. The wind picked up, now rushing north, then turning hard south, as though something massive were sucking air in and blowing it out again. Tomas and the priest looked at one another, the sound of the rustling leaves thick around them and the sky seeming to glow faintly green, though the sun was well down. The glowing coals of their fire went out entirely. The girl, Tomas said. The priest licked his lips and looked at the sky. A tar-black cloud of sorts bled up from Auxerre, tapered from the ground like a snake's tail spinning. He had heard of such a thing before. A sailor had told him of spouts that came down from the clouds and played on the face of the sea. But this one did not dip down from clouds. It rose from the ground and spread, making clouds where there had been none, blackening the faint green of the sky like ink polluting water. The tapered cloud, spinning ever faster, swayed now like a seductress at her dance, kicking up debris at its base. The two men thought they heard the sound of screaming, but it was impossible to tell if it was coming from Auxerre or the awful wind which blew harder now, sucking in, blowing out.
Mary, Mother of God, the priest said, wiping his lips with the back of his hand.
We have to find her, Tomas said, pulling the priest into the cart, but neither of them could make the mule move, so they went on foot, at something between a walk and a run, Tomas still limping on his hurt leg. Now the ground shook, as though something impossibly heavy had fallen. One corner of a stone farmhouse to their right collapsed, and the wind blew harder yet, slowing the men to the speed of a steep uphill walk.
Stinging twigs and other small missiles pelted them, and then a branch tumbled from the sky, catching the priest on the crown of his head, knocking him down. Tomas took his hand and yanked him up. They trudged on, coming to a higher place on the road. Shielding their faces with their arms as best they could, they saw that a second spinning cloud had joined the first, both of them tearing trees from the ground and sucking them upward. A man's shout rose from a farmhouse nearby, and the men saw why. The two clouds had broken contact with the ground. Their tapered bottoms became tails, and their thicker tops seemed to become wings. One of the clouds grew two great black wings, and the other grew six that seemed to fold in on one another.
Seraph, good sweet lord, a fallen seraph.
And, just like that, both of them bled themselves up into the larger cloud that now covered most of the sky. The exhausted priest stopped running and fell to his knees.
God, God, God!
Where are you?
The priest said.
Here!
Tomas said, but the priest was looking at the sky.
Where are you?
The priest now screamed, gnashing his teeth. Tomas yanked him up, but he pulled away, shaking his head. Finally, he collapsed against a tree and wrapped his arms around it, refusing to move farther. Tomas left him and trudged on for Auxerre, where the bells of the cathedral were ringing with great urgency. The cloud had become a proper thunderhead now, its tops chaining with jags of lightning. Everything about the sky was wrong. It was a sky of revelation. The ground shook again, harder than before, raising a chorus of shouts from the town. The bell stopped ringing. Tomas stopped walking now, transfixed by the spectacle taking place in the sky. And then he saw it. A great blackness against the sky. It circled twice, then stopped. How unlike a bird it was, though it had wings, or at least explained itself with them. No bird could just hang in the sky like a still image of itself. It peered down into the fields, its face almost feline, but wrong, its teeth black in a sickly glowing mouth. It roared, and its roar was familiar, that lion's roar in grotesque. An angel of wrath. A lion tearing an old man in an arena. It saw something that interested it. A great black limb, now an arm, now a sort of paw, reached down impossibly far and picked something up. A girl. Christ, no, no, not her. But it was not her. This girl was older and wore a dark dress, though her hair was the same length and color. She hung limply, doll-sized. The lion devil's two hot eyes regarded her. And then it huffed in disappointment, bit the legs from her, and flung her so she spun end over end into the greenish night. It was closer now, and a great stink came down from the sky, at once sour and burned. Still, it looked down in the fields, pulling the roofs from houses, knocking carts over to look beneath them. A flung cart hit the road near Tomas, its wheel flying off and striking the knight above the eye, knocking him to all fours. It was coming closer. It searched the road, the field. Tomas crawled into a gully and pulled branches over himself. But it was not looking for him. It wanted Delphine. Père Mathieu hugged his tree and shuddered, too afraid to move again, and too angry that God had abandoned them to these horrors.
Where are you? Where are you?
He said at intervals. But it was not until the wind calmed down that he heard a voice above.
Here,
it said. It was small and scared. Delphine. She was up a tree. Of course. She had run to the same strong old oak tree that had attracted him. With her to protect, some small strength came back to him. He let go of the trunk and reached up to her.
come down, he said.
No, you come up.
I'm old. I can't climb a tree.
If you don't, I think he will find you.
Who?
The fallen angel. The bad one. It's coming.
Père Mathieu Anicott climbed the tree. The wind picked up again. The priest prayed silently, forming his mouth around the unvoiced Latin, but giving no thought to the words. His mind was on the sky above them, and he listened, as she did, to the awful noise battering them from above, growing closer. The stink pouring down on them was as bad as the noise, and he fought hard not to retch, for fear that if he started, he wouldn't stop until he had fallen from the limb he clung to. The noise grew louder and closer yet, banging like fists inside his skull. He squared his mouth to scream, but Delphine's small hand stopped it. He looked up at her where she perched on the small branch above his. She pulsed her hand and shook her head no. Tears wet her cheeks, and her mouth too was a rictus, but she did not cry out. Don't, her eyes said. Please. He choked back the sound in his throat and clung tighter to the rough branch that swayed wildly in his arms and between his knees. The wind raged, needling his face and hands with small debris. He was becoming dizzy. Squinting, he glanced up to make sure the girl was still holding on, too. She was. But it was over them now. Its round mouth of fire hot behind backlit leaves. The idiot scream in his head formed into words.
Where are you, little whore? We'll find you if we have to pry up every roof from here to the sea and yank up every tree. That's it, isn't it? Your inner tree. We smell your fear close, your thoughts of how your death will be, but it will be worse, and death isn't the end of it. Yes, here we see you.
Now a white hand. A fucking hand. The size of a pony snaked down from the sky on the end of an arm with far too many joints. It pulled branches from their tree. Now the priest did scream, as did Delphine. More hands. 5, 6. They grabbed the tree now and heaved and shuddered it up from the earth. It turned upside down now, turning around Père Mathieu as he fell, buffeting him with branches and what leaves remained, but slowing his fall so when the earth rose and whacked his side and head and banged his knees together, he lost the wind from his lungs but broke nothing. He watched the tree recede above him, her face white in the foliage, her legs padlocked on her branch.
No!
He tried to scream, but his flat lungs allowed only a croak. The thing above him held the tree like a toy. It was an abomination. 6 wings, 6 arms, pulling the tree apart now.
Why must you hurt her? She's so small.
12 eyes glowing and a round mouth of fire. Père Mathieu clasped his hands together in prayer, unable to form words but imagining an angel of God coming down. Then he saw it. It came. A small moon, newly risen, amber behind the clouds, moving fast. One of the thing's 12 eyes cocked that way, but the rest stayed fixed on its task. It shook the tree. Something fell. One of those white hands just missed it. The girl. The priest stumbled to his feet, tried to get beneath her, but he was too far away, too old, too slow. Still he ran. He had some air in him now, and he cried out, God, please! The light from the cloud dove as a falcon would, one of the smallest and fastest of them, for which kings pay the price of towns, and it caught her. And was itself caught. A hand jerked its beautiful ankle. More tore at its wings. The forgotten tree tumbled, slowly, as if in a dream. The angel yanked backward,
lost its grip on the girl, and she fell again. Something from the other, a tail, grabbed for her and missed. A sword of pure moonlight flashed in the angel's hand. The two fought viciously as another dark shape closed in. The girl fell, closer to the ground now, close to the priest. He ran under her. Her form grew bigger, swiftly coming at him. Please, God! He caught her, mostly. His nose bloodied, his eye shut, his mouth full of grit. They rolled. She smelled of juniper. Somehow, he picked her up and ran. Tomas lay in his gully, covered in sticks, struggling to stay conscious. The wheel from the dropped cart had hurt him. He had to watch for the girl, but he could not tear his eyes from the fight. An angel and two devils. The end of the world. The battle pitched through the sky, careening over Auxerre, then back over the fields. Now a light, golden orange and lovely, just the sort the sun casts through clouds before it sinks, broke and lit up the river and the eastern part of town. Then everything went black, and the light shone only in flashes, painting scenes that formed in instants and dissolved into darkness again. Now a mass of black tentacles roped around the source of the light. Now a beautiful arm glowing with pale light flashed down with a sword, cutting some of these and causing the firmament to shudder like a ripple going through a pan of water. Tomas knew somehow that what he was seeing was not precisely true, but a translation. He had no way to understand what he was seeing, so his mind painted its own pictures. Now one black winged thing tore at the beautiful winged thing with a mouth like a lion's mouth, over which its two eyes blazed with insanity and rage. Now the six-winged darkness wheeled down, and fire from its round mouth spouted against the beautiful one in a huge gout that impacted against its target and was deflected, flowering and raining down all over the fields, lighting up the countryside here and there in a multitude of small fires. Everything went black again, until the three figures locked together, the black ones driving the illuminated one down and down into a field of barley not far from the river. A screaming sound that was at once animalistic and mechanical shocked Tomas's ears and raised all the small hairs on his body. The shock of their fall dug a deep trench, knocked trees down in a circle, their tops pointed away. In the barley field, great beings, beings the size of windmills, thrashed and rolled and gouged the earth. Two of them were as black as though holes had been cut in the fabric of the world. One shone like the full moon, just that heartbreaking in its beauty, casting mad shadows through the grain and the trees and along the hills as it moved. Now its light grew fainter, as the six-winged one pinned it down and smothered it. Tomas stood up to see the two-winged one rise up, filling the air with a lion's roar that was at once tortured and triumphant. Its great arms whipped down and thrust a spear at the source of the light, which sputtered and quit. The ground shuddered so hard that Tomas was knocked from his feet. At just that moment, every bird in the forest and fields cried out in a great cacophony, even those that sing only by day, so loud and crazed that it even drowned out the roaring wind. Tomas realized that he was shouting, but even realizing it, he couldn't stop. A warm rain began to fall, but what fell was thicker than water, smearing on the knight's face, even into his mouth, affronting it with the coppery, salty taste of blood. He covered his eyes with his hands and curled his knees up to his chin, still shouting hoarsely at the edge of his sanity. He passed from consciousness and, mercifully, dreamed nothing.